A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether Israel could solve its housing crunch by just building into the Negev, which is something like 60% of the country's land but barely populated. And if that's possible, what's actually stopping it from happening? It's one of those questions that sounds like it has an obvious answer until you start pulling at the threads.
The threads pull back hard. The Negev is about 13,000 square kilometers, more than half of Israel's landmass, but it's home to roughly 8% of the population. You've got Beer Sheva as the anchor city, a few development towns, some Bedouin communities, and then just vast stretches of geological silence. The instinct to say, just build there, makes total sense, especially when a four-room apartment in Tel Aviv costs more than a villa in most of the developed world.
That's a nice way of saying rocks and dust and the occasional ibex giving you a judgmental look.
The ibex are very judgmental. But here's the thing. People have been trying to crack this nut since Ben-Gurion was giving speeches about making the desert bloom. He literally retired to stay Boker in the Negev because he believed it was Israel's future. That was the 1950s. 70 plus years later, the Negev is still mostly empty, and it's not for lack of trying.
What's the actual bottleneck? Because the surface level answer is, nobody wants to live in a desert, but people live in Phoenix, people live in Dubai, people live in Las Vegas. Deserts aren't uninhabitable by default.
And the Negev isn't the Sahara. It's not endless dunes. You've got the Ramon Crater, you've got highlands, you've got the Arava Valley. Parts of it get cold in winter. But the first bottleneck is water, and it's a bigger deal than most people realize. Israel desalinates like a champion. Five major plants along the coast now, producing something like 600 million cubic meters a year. But desalinated water is on the coast. Getting it 60, 80, 100 kilometers inland and uphill into the Negev Highlands requires pumping infrastructure that doesn't fully exist at residential scale yet.
It's not that Israel can't make enough water. It's that the water is in the wrong place and moving it costs real money.
And water is heavy. Moving water uphill over long distances is energetically expensive. A study I saw estimated that pumping desalinated water from the Mediterranean coast to the central Negev highlands costs about 3 to 4 times what it costs to supply coastal cities. You're talking about a national water carrier system that was built in the 1960s and is already straining. Adding a major new population center in the deep Negev means either massive upgrades or localized desalination. And local desalination in the desert means you're desalinating brackish groundwater, not seawater, which comes with its own costs and brine disposal headaches.
Water is problem number one. What's number two? And please don't say jobs, because remote work exists, and we're living through the era where that argument should be losing weight.
I wish I could say remote work solves it, but it doesn't, not fully. And I say this as someone who's been a remote work advocate for years. The issue is that even remote workers need things. They need reliable high-speed internet, which is not uniformly available across the Negev. They need healthcare. You want a hospital within reasonable driving distance. They need schools for their kids. They need grocery stores, cultural outlets, some semblance of community infrastructure. You can't just drop 100,000 people into the desert with Starlink terminals and hope for the best.
Drop 100,000 people into the desert with Starlink terminals is the tech bro version of urban planning, and I'd watch that reality show, but fair enough.
There's a deeper issue with the jobs argument. The Negev does have some economic anchors. There's the tech park in Beer Sheva, the IDF's move south with the intelligence corps and communications bases, Ben-Gurion University, Soroka Medical Center. But these are concentrated around Beer Sheva. Once you move further south, toward Mitzpe Ramon, toward the Arava, the economic base thins out dramatically. Agriculture in the Arava exists and is impressive. They grow peppers and tomatoes for export using sophisticated drip irrigation, but it's not a massive employment driver. Tourism around the crater in Eilat is seasonal. There's no organic economic gravity pulling people into the deep desert.
Yet the IDF moved major bases down there. The intelligence campus, the training bases at Nevatim and Ramon. That was supposed to be the catalyst, right? Bring thousands of soldiers and career officers. Build housing around them. Create a civilian ecosystem.
That was the theory behind the IDF's Move South plan, which started in earnest around 2011 and accelerated through the late 2010s. The government spent something like 50 billion shekels, about $14 billion, relocating bases and building the training city at Ir HaBahadim, and it has moved people. Beersheba has grown. But here's the catch. A lot of the career personnel still commute from the center of the country. They drive down Sunday morning, stay in barracks or rented rooms during the week, and drive back Thursday night. The families don't relocate. The permanent civilian population bump has been smaller than projected.
Why don't the families move? If your spouse is stationed down there for years, wouldn't you want to be together?
You'd think so. But the spouse often has a job in Tel Aviv or the surrounding area. The kids are in schools with their friends. The grandparents are nearby. The cultural life, the restaurants, the beach, all of it is in the center. Moving to the Negev means giving up a lot, and the housing discount, while real, hasn't been enough to tip the scales for most families. There's a Times of Israel piece from about 18 months ago that interviewed families in this exact situation, and the phrase that kept coming up was, "We tried it for a year and moved back."
That's the gravity problem. The center has gravitational pull. Jobs, culture, family networks, the beach, the sheer density of everything, and the Negev has to fight against all of that. It's not enough to be cheaper. You have to be cheaper by enough margin to outweigh everything people are giving up.
That margin keeps shifting. Land in the Negev is cheap, sometimes absurdly cheap compared to the center, but construction costs aren't that different. Concrete, steel, labor. Those cost roughly the same whether you're building in Kiryat Ono or Dimona. The land cost savings get partially eaten by higher infrastructure costs, longer utility runs, water pumping, road extensions. So the final per unit cost isn't as dramatically lower as the raw land prices would suggest.
What's the actual price difference right now? If I'm looking at a four-room apartment in Tel Aviv versus a comparable new build-in, say, Beersheba or Yerevan.
A four-room apartment in Tel Aviv, we're talking about 110 square meters, is running somewhere around 3.5 to 4 million shekels, easily more in desirable neighborhoods. That's roughly 950,000 to $1,000,001 in dollars. In Beersheba, a comparable new-build apartment might be 1.2 to 1.5 million shekels, call it $350,000 to $450,000. So you're looking at a 60 to 65% discount. In Yerevan or Dimona, you might get down to 800,000 shekels, around $220,000. That's a 75 to 80% discount from Tel Aviv.
That's massive. That should be enough. 80% off the biggest expense in your life, and people still aren't moving?
They are moving, just not in the numbers that would fundamentally rebalance the country. The Negev has been growing. Beersheba's metro area is up to about 400,000 people now. But the Tel Aviv metro area is over 4 million. The scale difference is enormous. To meaningfully relieve pressure on the center, you'd need to move hundreds of thousands of people south, not tens of thousands.
Okay, so we've got water costs, infrastructure costs, the gravity problem of the center, and the chicken and egg problem of jobs and amenities. What about the Bedouin communities? Because that's a whole dimension of land use complexity in the Negev that doesn't get talked about enough.
This is where it gets genuinely complicated, and I want to be careful here because it's easy to oversimplify. The Bedouin population in the Negev is around 300,000 people, about a third of the Negev's total population. Some live in recognized townships like Rahat, Hura, Kusaife. These were established by the state starting in the 1970s. Others live in what are called unrecognized villages, communities that predate the state, or were established without formal planning approval, and which the state doesn't provide with infrastructure like water, electricity, or paved roads.
The unrecognized villages sit on land that would otherwise be... what? State land available for development?
That's the crux of the conflict. Many of these villages sit on land that the state claims as state land, while the Bedouin residents claim traditional ownership going back generations. There have been decades of legal battles, land claims, negotiations, and periodic demolitions. The BeginProR plan from around 2013 was supposed to resolve a lot of this. It would have recognized many of the villages and compensated residents, but it collapsed under political pressure from both sides. Bedouin leadership felt it didn't go far enough, right-wing politicians felt it went too far, and so the status quo persists.
Which means that if the government announces a major new housing initiative in the Negev, the first question is, on whose land? And the second question is, what happens to the unrecognized villages in the development zone?
And this isn't a small friction, it's a fundamental land use question that affects hundreds of thousands of people and vast tracts of land. Any large-scale Negev development plan either has to work around the Bedouin land claims, which constrains where you can build, or resolve them, which is politically explosive. There's no third option.
Far we've got water, infrastructure, economic gravity, and unresolved land claims. What about transportation? Because if you're trying to convince people to live in the Negev, and maybe commute to the center occasionally, the train starts to matter a lot.
The train matters immensely. Right now, Israel Railways runs a line from Tel Aviv to Be'er Sheva that takes about an hour and 15 minutes. It's not bad. There's a slower line from Be'er Sheva further south to Dimona, but it's limited service. And there's no passenger rail at all to Eilat, which has been discussed for decades and never built. The big project that's supposed to change things is the fast train to Be'er Sheva, a planned electrified line that would cut the Tel Aviv to Be'er Sheva trip to about 45 minutes. But that project has been delayed repeatedly. Original completion was supposed to be around 2022, then 2025, and as of now we're looking at 2027 or 2028 at the earliest.
45 minutes from Be'er Sheva to Tel Aviv changes the calculus considerably. That's a commute people do in major cities. You could live in Be'er Sheva, pay a quarter of the housing cost, and be in your Tel Aviv office faster than someone driving from Netanyah.
It changes everything for Be'er Sheva and its immediate ring. But it doesn't help Mitzpe Ramon, it doesn't help the Arava, it doesn't help anywhere that's more than 20 minutes from the Be'er Sheva station. The Negev is big. Be'er Sheva to Eilat is about 250 kilometers. That's roughly the distance from Tel Aviv to the northern tip of the Red Sea. A train to Eilat would cost billions and take over a decade to build. So the rail solution, even if it works perfectly, only activates the northern Negev.
We're really talking about the northern Negev as the feasible development zone, the Be'er Sheva orbit. The deep Negev is a different conversation entirely.
The deep Negev is essentially a frontier zone. The Arava has about 50,000 people spread across a string of agricultural communities. Mitzpe Ramon has about 5,000. Eilat has about 50,000 and is its own thing, a resort city at the southern tip with a completely different economic logic. None of these are positioned to absorb major population growth without enormous investment. And Eilat specifically has its own housing crisis because it's hemmed in by mountains and the Red Sea. There's physically limited land to build on.
Let's zoom out and talk about what's actually happening on the policy side. The government clearly knows all of this. Are there serious plans to develop the Negev, or is it mostly speeches and ribbon cuttings?
There are real plans, and they've been evolving. The most significant recent framework is Negev 2030, or some branding variant, which the government has been pushing since the late 2010s. The core ideas are, finish the fast train, expand Be'er Sheva's tech ecosystem, build new neighborhoods in the ring towns like Ofakim and Netivot, and create incentives for young families to move south. There have been tax breaks, subsidized land for developers, and targeted infrastructure spending. Be'er Sheva has transformed. The old city has been renovated, there's a growing high-tech presence, the university is strong. Ofakim and Netivot have grown. But the growth is mostly organic and incremental, not the kind of step change that would meaningfully relieve pressure on the center. And some of the development has been, let's say, uneven. You get these new neighborhoods of identical villas plopped down on the edge of the desert, no commercial center, no public space, just housing units. People move in, realize there's nothing there, and either leave or spend their lives in their cars.
The build it and they will come. Approach, minus the build anything other than housing part.
It's the classic Israeli planning failure. Build the residential units and assume commercial and community infrastructure will follow organically. Sometimes it does. Often it doesn't, and you get dormitory towns where nobody wants to live unless they have no other choice.
What about the idea of building a new city from scratch? Not expanding Beersheva, not adding neighborhoods to Dimona, but actually planning and building a new city in the Negev, the way Modian was built in the 90s between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
This has been proposed multiple times. There was a plan floated around 2017 for a new city called Nivi Ilan, or Ilan, in the northern Negev, aimed at housing 50,000 people initially, growing to 100,000. There was another concept for a city near the Egypt border called Zur Yitzhak. Neither has broken ground. The planning hurdles are immense. Environmental impact studies, land use approvals, infrastructure budgeting that spans multiple government ministries and Knesset terms. And there's a deeper question. Who moves to a brand new city in the desert with no history, no established community, no track record?
People move to Modian.
Modian had a few advantages. It's roughly equidistant between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You can commute to either. It's in the green, hilly center of the country, not the desert. And it was built in the 90s when there was massive immigration from the former Soviet Union, creating huge housing demand. None of those conditions apply to a new Negev city. You're asking pioneers, not just commuters.
That's an interesting word. Pioneers. Is there a cultural dimension here? The early Zionists had a whole mythology around pioneering and making the desert bloom. Does any of that survive as a cultural motivator, or has it been fully replaced by, I want a short commute and good coffee?
It survives in pockets. The Arava communities have a strong pioneering ethos. You meet people there who love the desert, love the challenge, love the quiet. The religious Zionist movement has a significant presence in the Negev through the Or movement and similar organizations that actively recruit families to move to development towns in the south and strengthen communities there. There are environmentalists and desert ecology enthusiasts. But as a mass market proposition, live in the desert for ideological reasons competes poorly with live near the beach and your mother.
Your mother, critically, is not in the desert.
The grandmother factor is real and under-discussed in housing policy. Israeli family structures are tight. Grandparents provide massive amounts of free childcare. Move 2 hours away, and that childcare network evaporates. For young families with two working parents, that's not a small consideration. It's potentially thousands of shekels a month in additional costs. Housing might be cheaper in the Negev, but if you're suddenly paying for full-time daycare that grandma was handling for free, the math shifts.
The housing cost savings get nibbled at from multiple directions. Higher water and infrastructure costs get partially passed through. Transportation costs increase if you ever need to get to the center. And childcare costs can spike if you lose the family network. The headline discount is real, but the all-in cost of living gap is narrower.
We haven't even talked about climate. The Negev is hot and getting hotter. Summer temperatures in Beersheva regularly hit 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 Fahrenheit. Further south, it's worse. Air conditioning is not optional, it's a survival necessity, and it's a significant electricity cost. Climate projections for the region suggest increasing heat extremes over the next several decades. If you're making a 30-year housing decision, you have to factor in what the Negev summer looks like in 2050.
That's the kind of long-term thinking that most home buyers don't do, and probably should. Will this place be habitable in 30 years? Is not a question people ask at open houses.
They ask about countertops and bathroom fixtures. But the climate question is going to force itself onto the agenda eventually. The Negev is already experiencing desertification intensification. That sounds redundant, but it's not. Existing arid zones are becoming more extreme. Water evaporation rates increase, soil quality degrades. Agricultural viability in the Arava, which depends on very specific microclimate conditions, gets threatened.
Let's talk about the security dimension. The Negev borders Egypt and Jordan, and it's been relatively quiet on those fronts for decades. But quiet isn't the same as permanent. Does security risk factor into development decisions?
It does, though it's rarely the primary factor. The Egypt border has been stable since the peace treaty, and the fence built along the Sinai border around 2013 has been effective at stopping infiltration. The Jordan border is even quieter. But the Negev is also where Israel's most sensitive military installations are. Dimona, the nuclear research center, is there. The IAF's largest bases are there. The missile testing ranges are there. This creates constraints. Certain areas are off-limits for civilian development, and there are flight path and security buffer considerations that don't apply in the center.
The occasional rocket from Gaza reaches the northern Negev. Beersheva and the surrounding towns have been in range during every round of fighting.
Yes, though Iron Dome coverage in the south is extensive, and the threat from Gaza has been significantly degraded, especially after the war that started in 2023. But you're right, security perception matters. Families considering a move to the Negev ask about bomb shelters and warning times, and those are not questions that come up in Ra'anana.
To summarize the obstacles, water infrastructure costs, the economic gravity of the center, the chicken and egg problem of jobs and amenities, unresolved Bedouin land claims, transportation limitations, especially for the deep Negev, higher all in living costs than the headline housing discount suggests, climate trajectory concerns, security perceptions, and the grandmother problem. Did I miss anything?
You missed bureaucracy, but that's almost too obvious to mention. Israel's planning and zoning system is legendarily slow. Getting a new neighborhood approved can take years. Getting a new city approved can take decades. There are multiple layers of committees, local, district, national, and each one is a veto point. Developers routinely sit on approved land for years waiting for infrastructure connections that the government promised but hasn't delivered. The whole system is optimized for incremental expansion, not transformative scale.
Optimized for incremental expansion is a generous way of saying designed by people who never wanted anything to change.
It's the institutional equivalent of saying, we'll get to it next quarter for 40 years.
What would actually work? If you were put in charge of Negev development with a real budget and political backing, what would you do that's different from what's been tried?
I'd start by being honest about what's achievable. The deep Negev is not going to become a population center in our lifetimes. It's too far, too hot, too expensive to service. The focus should be on the Be'er Sheva to Kiryat Gat corridor, which already has some economic momentum and will benefit from the fast train. I'd prioritize dense, mixed-use development around the train stations rather than sprawl, build up, not out. I'd co-locate government offices and public sector jobs in the south, not just military bases, move entire ministries or significant branches of them. I'd invest heavily in making Beersheba a genuine cultural destination, not just a place where people sleep. And I'd resolve the Bedouin land claims through negotiation and recognition, because the current ambiguity is a drag on development for everyone.
The government office relocation idea is interesting. Israel's government is absurdly centralized in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Moving, say, the Interior Ministry or the Tax Authority to Beersheba would bring thousands of stable, middle-class jobs and their associated demand for housing, schools, and services. That's the kind of anchor that private development can cluster around.
It's been done elsewhere. Germany moved significant government functions from Bonn to Berlin after reunification. Different context, obviously, but the principle holds. South Korea is trying to move functions out of Seoul to Sejong City. Egypt is building a whole new administrative capital in the desert east of Cairo. These projects are expensive and politically difficult, but they demonstrate that government-led relocation can shift population gravity over time.
Egypt's new capital is a fascinating comparison, actually. They're building it about 45 kilometers east of Cairo, in the desert, with a target population of 6.5 million people. It's been under construction since around 2015. The price tag is something like $58 billion, and it's controversial. Critics call it a vanity project for the military and the elite, and question whether ordinary Egyptians will actually move there.
That's the cautionary tale. You can build the buildings, you can build the roads and the water pipes and the government ministries. But if you haven't created the conditions for organic community formation, the stuff that makes people actually want to live somewhere, you end up with an expensive ghost town. We've seen this in China with some of their new cities. We've seen it in other parts of the Middle East. Infrastructure is necessary, but not sufficient.
Infrastructure is necessary, but not sufficient. Is basically the epitaph for every planned city that didn't work.
It should be carved in stone somewhere, probably in the Negev.
Let's talk about something that might actually tip the scales, the cost trajectory in the center. If Tel Aviv housing continues to become more unaffordable, and there's no reason to think it won't, at some point the math becomes irresistible. $1 million for a four-room apartment versus $220,000 for the same thing in Dimona. At some ratio, people start moving not because they want to, but because they have to.
That's already happening. The towns around Be'er Sheva, Ofakim, Nativo, Stero have seen population growth driven partly by young families priced out of the center. Stero in particular has grown significantly. These are not people making an ideological choice, they're making a math choice. And this organic, market-driven dispersion is probably more powerful in the long run than any government master plan.
The question is whether the infrastructure and amenities arrive fast enough to retain them. Because if you move to Ofakim to save money, but there's no good high school, and the only entertainment option is the mall in Be'er Sheva, 40 minutes away, you might stick it out for a few years and then find a way back to the center.
That's the retention challenge, and it's where local government quality matters enormously. Some Negev municipalities are well-run and actively investing in quality of life. Parks, cultural events, school improvements, less well-run. The variation is significant, and it directly affects whether newcomers stay or leave.
What's the honest answer to the original question? Could Israel radically increase housing supply by developing the Negev?
The honest answer is yes, but only in the northern Negev, only with massive infrastructure investment that hasn't fully materialized yet, only if the fast train actually gets finished, only if jobs follow the housing rather than the other way around, and only if the Bedouin land situation gets resolved rather than perpetually deferred. That's a lot of only ifs. The potential is real. The land is there, the need is there, the technological capacity to build in desert conditions exists. But the political will to do all the unglamorous enabling work has been inconsistent at best.
For the deep Negev, Mitzpeh Ramon, the Arava, the area south of the crater, the answer is basically no, at least for anything approaching mass population. Those will remain niche communities for people who specifically want the desert life.
Which is fine, by the way. Not everywhere needs to be a metropolis. The deep Negev has value as open space, as ecological reserve, as military training area, as tourism destination. The goal shouldn't be to pave it over. The goal should be to concentrate development where it makes sense and do it well.
The Negev as a housing solution is real but bounded. It can help. It is helping, but it's not going to single-handedly solve Israel's housing crisis. The center will remain expensive. The periphery will grow incrementally, and the people who expected a desert development miracle will keep being disappointed.
The miracle was never going to happen. What can happen is steady, well-planned growth that gradually shifts some percentage of the population southward, coupled with real investment in making those southern communities places people want to stay. That's less exciting than a new city rising from the sands, but it's actually achievable.
The Negev is not the savior of Israeli housing, but it's a useful pressure release valve that's currently operating at about 30% of its potential because of policy failures.
And I'd add that the biggest single lever the government could pull tomorrow, not in 10 years, not after a multi-billion shekel infrastructure project, is resolving the Bedouin land claims. That unlocks vast amounts of land for planning, removes a constant source of legal uncertainty, and allows both Bedouin communities and new development to proceed with clarity. Everything else takes a decade. That could start next month, if the political will existed.
Which brings us back to the grandmother problem, the water problem, the train problem, and the fact that it's really hot. Israel's housing crisis is real and painful, but the Negev is a partial answer, not a total one. And partial answers are still worth pursuing. They just shouldn't be oversold.
The desert doesn't owe us a solution. We have to build it, and we have to be realistic about what's buildable. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1905, while observing the moon from Tierra del Fuego, French astronomer Georges Atlantique recorded a strange orange glow near the crater Aristarchus that he named Le Clignotement du Renard, the blinking of the fox, after a local Patagonian legend about a fox that stole fire from the moon. The phenomenon was never independently confirmed, and modern astronomers believe he probably saw a weather balloon catching the sunset.
A weather balloon catching the sunset.
The fox stole the fire. Corn. The fox stole the fire. This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Herman Poppleberry.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.